Some of you have asked me how I come up with sermon topics, and if I ever find myself at a loss for words, and that may happen someday, but as you'll find out, today is not that day. Today I have a story for you, a story I encountered in a book our reading came from called The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. The author, Michelle Alexander, is a law professor at Ohio State University and also works with the Kirwan Institute for the study of race and ethnicity. She was a guest speaker at our denomination's General Assembly last June, and you can see her and hear her presentation online at uua.org if you so wish. Alexander's story is powerful and disturbing, and it challenged my sense of who we are as a nation. It also made clear to me that my own privilege as a white liberal shapes my views in substantial ways. It was not an easy story to read. I think it will resonate with some of you, and still others may take issue with it. It is my hope that you will have one or the other of those reactions rather than simply feeling indifferent. Author Bodhi Taney wrote, "Apathy is the glove into which evil slips its hand." And this turned out to be the moral of the story for me. At the heart of the story is the notion that we as a nation have purposefully created and actively maintained laws and practices that stigmatize and marginalize brown and black Americans. This is a serious accusation made in no uncertain terms. Perhaps it surprises you as it did me. It struck me at first as exaggerated, maybe even paranoid. After all, we've come a long way in this country, haven't we? Didn't the Emancipation Proclamation and the Civil War end slavery? Didn't we march for civil rights in the 60s along with Dr. Martin Luther King? Don't we Unitarian Universalists welcome everyone because we believe in equality? Well, some things have changed, but according to Alexander, the dehumanization and marginalization of African Americans, particularly African American men, has been a constant thread throughout our history in powerful, pervasive ways. We may want to believe racial discrimination is largely a thing of the past. We point to our president and tell our children that anyone can succeed regardless of our racial identity. We may want to believe that we live in a society where the color of one's skin is not a factor in the workings of our laws or criminal justice system. Those beliefs may comfort us and ease the pain of our shameful past of bigotry, but the facts tell a different story. Michelle Alexander asserts that we no longer enslave people of African descent. Instead, we round them up and incarcerate them for drug offenses. And when these mostly young men are released from prison, whether they serve 2 months or 20 years, our justice system legally and permanently denies them employment, public housing, education, and public services. You may be thinking about now, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime, right? No one forces anyone here in America to buy, sell, or take drugs. These young men made bad choices and they have to pay. But let's consider some numbers. I'm going to read a paragraph from the book. The impact of the drug wars has been astounding. In less than 30 years, the U.S. penal population exploded from about 300,000 to more than 2 million, with drug convictions accounting for the majority of the increase. The United States now has the highest rate of incarceration in the world, dwarfing the rates of nearly every developed country, even surpassing those in highly repressive regimes like Russia, China, and Iran. In Germany, 93 people are in prison for every 100,000 adults and children. In the United States, the rate is roughly 8 times that, or 750 per 100,000. The racial dimension of mass incarceration is its most striking feature. No other country in the world imprisons so many of its racial or ethnic minorities. The United States imprisons a large percentage of its black population, larger than South Africa did at the height of apartheid. In Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, it is estimated that 3 out of 4 young black men, and nearly all those in the poorest neighborhoods, can expect to serve time in prison. Similar rates of incarceration can be found in black communities across America. End quote. So let's think about this. If whites make up about 2/3 of the adult population in the United States, and every study done on drug use shows that whites are more likely to use and sell drugs than people of color, we would expect roughly 3 out of 4 people in prison for drug crimes should be white. But this is not the case. Not even close. Nationwide, an African American man is 13 times more likely to go to prison for a drug offense than a white man. According to Human Rights Watch, in not one single state in the nation are whites incarcerated for drug crimes at the rate that matches their percentage of the population at large. In fact, in 7 states, African Americans constitute 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison. Most Americans, when polled, say they support institutionalized racial equality, but these numbers make clear that our criminal justice system is not colorblind, even without specific laws directly targeting racial minorities. The obvious conclusion is that the laws we do have are being selectively enforced in communities of color. Michelle Alexander's thesis is that the mass incarceration and subsequent marginalization of young black and brown men is simply a continuum of the racial control that has always existed in America from our earliest days, a form of control that benefits the wealthy elite exactly the same way slavery did. To understand this, let's review some history. In 17th century America, it was not unusual for whites and blacks to work together on plantations as indentured servants. In 1676, a white landowner from Virginia named Nathaniel Bacon started a rebellion that attempted to unite slaves, indentured servants, and poor whites in an effort to overthrow the plantation owners. The rebellion failed, but the plantation owners learned from the experience. They learned that if they wanted to avoid similar uprisings, they would need to find a new source of labor, a source they could more easily control. They began to rely more and more on slaves from Africa, who did not know English, and thus would be less likely to build alliances. The elite effectively split the labor force down racial lines, giving special privileges to poor whites, so that all whites, rich and poor alike, would have a personal stake in the maintenance of a race-based system of slavery. In the years that followed, white supremacy became the norm. After the Civil War and emancipation, white Southerners, fearing retaliation from their former slaves, began promoting stereotypes of black men as threatening. So-called Jim Crow laws were passed in the South, designed to enforce segregation at every level of society. For example, vagrancy laws made it illegal not to have a job. This law was selectively applied to blacks, providing ample reason to imprison them. These laws appealed to lower-class whites who didn't have economic opportunities themselves, but who were comforted by the idea that at least they were better off than their black neighbors. The wealthy couldn't keep slaves anymore, but Jim Crow gave them the same access to a racial underclass that could be exploited for cheap labor. Fast forward to the 1960s, when the civil rights movement took hold and began to threaten Jim Crow. Those of you who lived through this time may remember that those opposed to civil rights legislation constantly lifted up, quote, law and order, as a reason to deny civil rights. Once again, race was used as a wedge by the politically powerful to disrupt organized efforts to improve the lives of the poor and the working class. By the time of Ronald Reagan's candidacy for president, openly racist language could not be used anymore, so instead, coded appeals were used. Who here remembers stories of welfare queens taking advantage of the system and food stamp freeloaders? Some of you may also remember when Reagan's administration initiated the war on drugs. Interestingly, less than 2% of the American public thought that drugs were the most important issue facing the country at that time, which is not surprising when we consider that illegal drug use was actually on the decline at that time. Immediately after the war on drugs was declared, anti-drug enforcement funding increased as much as tenfold into the hundreds of millions of dollars. Meantime, funding for drug treatment, prevention, and education was drastically reduced. While the drug war was taking hold, inner-city communities were disintegrating because blue-collar jobs were disappearing. I learned as I was preparing for this sermon that crime rates rise as joblessness rises. The correlation is not with drug use. So the jobs disappeared in black communities, and then came crack cocaine. Although crack cocaine was no more of a problem than powder cocaine was in more affluent communities, the Reagan administration jumped all over it, and the airways were suddenly flooded with stories of black crack whores, crack babies, and gangbangers. Remember that? Mandatory multi-year minimum sentences were mandated, even for first-time nonviolent drug offenses. But not for white folks, and not for powder cocaine. In 1989, President Bush described drug use as, quote, the most pressing problem facing the nation. The anti-drug PR campaign had worked. 64% of those polled at the time agreed that drugs were enemy number one. But this change in public opinion did not correspond to any actual increase in illegal drug activity. Michelle Alexander believes that here again we have the same song with a different tune. Middle-class whites were being sold a story that perpetuated the rigid caste system, keeping brown and black men from participating in society as equals. The Clinton administration doubled down on the get tough on crime theme. Three strikes and you're out legislation resulted in the largest increase in prison population of any president in American history. Clinton oversaw legislation that created lifetime bans on welfare and food stamps and public housing eligibility for anyone convicted of a felony drug offense, including simple possession of marijuana. During the Clinton presidency, spending on the penal system more than doubled what had been previously spent on welfare and food stamps. Public housing funding was cut by $17 billion, while prison spending increased by more than $19 billion. Who needs public housing when you can put people in prison instead? And prisons are big business, providing lots of employment for those not being arrested for drug crimes. Here's a piece of information that I didn't know, an important part of the story. Since the very beginning of the war on drugs, the federal government has offered financial incentives to state and local law enforcement to make drug-related arrests. The more people arrested on drug charges, the more subsidies law enforcement could get. These incentives made drug policing a priority, and every administration since Reagan's has continued offering these federal subsidies, including President Obama, who has increased that funding. So there's a lot of money to be made on drug arrests, and the easiest place to make those arrests is in communities without the political power to fight back. So it's no wonder that most of the emphasis on the war on drugs has been focused on underprivileged communities, especially communities of color. Even though law enforcement cannot officially use racial profiling to conduct their searches, the Supreme Court has repeatedly given free rein to police to pull over and search anyone at any time, as long as it cannot be proven that the only reason they pulled some over was race. If you're involved in what an officer might find to be suspicious activity, you can be searched. This could include committing a minor traffic violation, such as a rolling stop, or a turn without a signal, or even driving with a scrupulous obedience to traffic laws. In other words, if you look like you're being too careful. Some of us know this as a DWB, or driving while black. Ask any young man of color about this. They know. Unless you can prove an officer pulled you over solely because of your race, which is virtually impossible, you cannot claim racial bias. I've been pulled over exactly twice in almost 40 years of driving. Once I was driving barefoot without my headlights on and no license, and once my taillight was out. Not only was my car not searched for drugs, I wasn't even ticketed. I grew up in a town where there are plenty of illegal drugs. I had friends who smoked dope every weekend. At Cal, the student co-op I lived in had its own marijuana garden, and the job of taking care of it was a regular work shift. I wasn't particularly into drugs, but I knew who had them for sale. We didn't feel the slightest bit of concern about being caught. No one I knew faced jail time, legal fees, prosecution, or the permanent consequence of a criminal record. Those things were reserved for Richmond gangbangers. Our parents had money and could hire lawyers. Can you imagine SWAT teams busting into dorm rooms in the middle of the night? What if college students who had an ounce of marijuana under their bed got sentenced to 5 years in jail? Are the police going to bust down my door and search my house for illegal prescription drugs? Can you imagine the outrage if that happened in the suburbs? And yet, it happens every day in communities of color. Most of these drug cases never go to trial. Those arrested can't afford a lawyer, so they're assigned an overworked public defender who pressures them into accepting plea bargains to avoid very harsh sentences. The guilty are then removed from their families and from their communities, sent off to prisons and jails, and locked up for crimes that are notoriously overlooked when committed by whites. Then those whose only crimes may have been drug addiction or possession of a small amount of recreational drugs for personal use are left with permanent criminal records, ensuring they will never be able to again participate in mainstream society. They're denied employment, housing, education, and public services, leading many to eventually return to prison, because remember, joblessness correlates with high crime rates. It is this self-perpetuating cycle of incarceration and marginalization that Alexander labels the new Jim Crow. We might ask ourselves, why is it that the war on drugs has received so much financial and political support? Why are we as a society so focused on this issue when the number of deaths due to illegal drugs is tiny compared to those caused by, say, drunk drivers, and when driving 10 miles an hour over the speed limit on the freeway puts yourself and others at more risk than someone smoking marijuana in the privacy of his or her own living room? The answer popped right out at me from my place of privilege. Why should I care? What does the war on drugs have to do with me or the people I care about? Absolutely nothing. Michelle Alexander believes that the mass incarceration of black men has resulted from the war on drugs, that it's perpetuated by racial indifference, by the lack of compassion for a racial group that is penalized and marginalized far beyond what is necessary, fair, and just. Is this really okay with me? With us as Unitarian Universalists? Economist Glenn Lowry questions why we are, quote, willing to cast ourselves as a society that creates crime-producing conditions for some of its members, then acts out rituals of punishment against them as if engaged in some awful form of human sacrifice, end quote. I wonder if in our yearning to leave our ugly history of racism behind, we have become blind to racial differences that we need to see. As Martin Luther King said, nothing in all the world is more dangerous than sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity. Should we try to stop the war on drugs? Any system, Alexander says, that, quote, shames and blames its most vulnerable, affixes badges of dishonor upon them at a young age, and then relegates them to a permanent second-class status for life, end quote, must no longer be acceptable to fair-minded people. Is it acceptable to us as Unitarian Universalists? And if not, what can we do? I believe that a critical first step is to face the fact that we do not live in a post-racial society, a colorblind society, even if we do have a biracial president. White privilege, for those of us who identify as white, allows us to ignore racism, if we choose to, without any consequences. But communities of color pay the price for that privilege. Racial differences will always exist. If we truly believe in the worth and dignity of all people, we need to make an effort to understand the reality of our different experiences in the world. If you're interested in exploring the subject of white privilege further, I would encourage you to get in touch with our intern, Jen Gray, as this is a special interest of hers. She's eager to host a discussion group or class on the subject. I want to mention that just after Jen began her internship with us, she remembered that she and I had met once before at an Allies for Racial Equity conference back in March of 2008 in Memphis. So she's been interested in justice work and particularly the subject of privilege for a long time. If you feel ready to speak out about the war on drugs, our Social Justice Committee is ready to support you. They brought some writing materials so you can write a letter here after the service to our state senators or to President Obama. And I recommend that you read Michelle Alexander's book. I found it compelling, and it deeply affected the way I see our culture and even myself. We learned from the civil rights era that to change society, you need a large group of people who find things as they are unacceptable. We have been those people in the past, and perhaps we need to be those people again now. I'd like to end with the words of the Reverend Dr. Matthew Johnson Doyle, who said this to his congregation earlier this year. Ending a racial caste system doesn't just involve changing policies. It also involves changing hearts. I don't know if I've changed any hearts today, but if I've provoked you into being willing to think about this some more, to learn more and discover more, then that'll do. As you learn, as you listen, as we share what we have learned, may the hearts of those in power and the hearts of those in fear be changed too. Amen. And may it be so.